M1 is the finance super app that puts you in control of your wealth. Invest, borrow, save, and spend your money how you want with sophisticated automation tools to help you reach your financial goals more easily. 2021 is about rebuilding, building health, building wealth, and everything in between. I've been using M1 for years to manage my long-term investment portfolio. M1 lets me follow some of the top-performing hedge funds like Code2 and balance my pie based on what the pros are doing. It's truly my favorite investing app in the world. Go to m1finance.com/Katoon to get started today and earn $30 to invest after you fund your account. Terms and conditions apply. M1, yours to build. Welcome to Technori Podcast. I'm Scott Katoon. On today's show, we catch up with Mooch, Anthony Scaramucci, the founder of SkyBridge, the former communications officer for now out of work Donald J. Trump asshole. I don't have to hide that I don't like the man. Scaramucci doesn't have to hide that he doesn't like the man. But what he also doesn't hide is the fact that he got himself into a bit of a trick bag. He let his ego, something we all can absolutely empathize with, get the best of him. He believed that there was an opportunity for him personally, professionally, to answer to the man, the American president. And who doesn't want to work for the president? You watch West Wing? You watch the movie The American President? I want to work for the president. Particularly if you're a power broker and you're a person who's in charge of managing a ton of money. It's a great place to be. I get it. Do I get that you don't see that Donald Trump is a gigantic asshole? No, but I don't think anyone actually truly believed that he was as fucking nuts as he is. And you can look at the Billy Bush stuff and the way that he mistreats people and all that, and you should tell me, like, listen, dude, it's obvious. He's a bad dude. But there's a weird thing, man. Popular, successful people, many of them are bad dudes or bad dudettes in some regard. I don't think you want to believe that this person is completely crazy, that he's running a cult, and he's doing it from the Oval Office. So I can't fault Mooch for wanting this role. I can't. And he doesn't even fault himself for it. I think he faults himself for buying into ego and to making decisions that aren't necessarily based on what's the right thing. But the part about Mooch that I love, and the part that I think you guys are going to learn a lot from in this conversation, is that he is a master at understanding his own frailty and admitting when he's wrong and not hiding from it. He was very public on his way out that this person is a fucking madman and that you couldn't even possibly comprehend how bad he is internally. Like, what you see on the outside is nothing compared to how nuts it got on the inside. So I don't fault him. Not at all. And I'll tell you another thing. I follow him on Twitter. It's at Scaramucci. You should too. He now follows me, but that's at the end of the show. I can't tell you how excited I am. I've been holding this conversation back from y'all for weeks, waiting for the minute. We booked this before Trump election was official and he is out of here. So I have been waiting. January 20th came and I wanted to yell, Mooch, come on my show now, but I couldn't. I've been waiting this long. The conversation does not disappoint. We obviously talk about Donald Trump. We shit on him a little bit because why not? We talk a little bit about investing and what happened with GameStop, which I think everyone and their brother and sister has learned now what is happening, down hundreds of percents as of the day of this recording. Many, many people made a lot of money early, most of them pros, and many of them lost a lot of money. And some of them are still pros and they lost a lot of money. But I think there's a lesson to be learned here. And it's not the big conversation, the Robin Hood conversation. It's the early retail investor conversation. In order to truly become a good investor, I believe this, and many people have said it, you have to lose. You have to take a shot. And I think every American has the right to take a shot. And this was it for some of them, for some of you, for me. I made good on one. I lost my ass on another. That's life. You can't live in the ought to world, as Mooch says. Ought is a bad, bad word. Is a word that I like to live with, and Mooch does too. And that's a word that is reality, living in reality. We talked about this and a whole lot more. Here's my conversation with Anthony Scaramucci. All right. Mooch is on my show. I've been waiting weeks for this. First off, beautiful office, beautiful home studio. How's it going? What's going on in your world?
Hey, well, listen, it's great to be here with you. I am trapped in my office like Joe Biden. I've been in the basement, so I had to beat Trump up from the basement. I had to grow my business and reorientate my business from the basement, but I'm very excited to be here with you.
I appreciate that. Since we're starting here, yay for Joe Biden, fuck Donald Trump. It's never been more fun to beat up on someone. And I feel bad about that because, like, I'm not a bully type person. I don't like it. He is. But it was never more pleasurable than just like sitting on my sofa, watching him be stupid and just calling shit out on Twitter. That was a joy.
You know, unfortunately, you know, we had high expectations. I've been accused by the radical left of supporting a racist and all this other stuff, you know. I thought part of that stuff was an act by him. I didn't realize he was going to go to this level that he went to. Yeah. Obviously, everybody's revising history and telling themselves that they knew all this with absolute perfection and everybody was a seer. I wasn't. But listen, like I tell my kids, you know, when you get something wrong, it's okay to be wrong, but it's not okay to stay wrong. And you have to put a foot down and you have to declare what you saw, what you realized you got wrong. And so, you know, 2 years ago, I went out on a limb. At that time, it was the highest approval ratings that he had. People were talking about the inevitability of his reelection. I said, there's no way. There's something wrong with this guy. He's absolutely nuts. And then, he went on to mishandle the pandemic. 13 million jobs lost in the 4 years. $8 trillion of deficit spending. Made the country weaker, sicker, and poorer. And got his ass impeached twice. Okay, but what you see on the surface, what I would say to you that John Kelly and I, who have become very close friends, that's great irony because he fired my ass right 3 years ago. But John and I have done speaking engagements all over the world. We've become very close friends, most recently in Iowa about 3 weeks ago. And what John would say if he was on this podcast with you, Scott, is that this son of a bitch, as bad as you may think he is from looking at him in the TV, he is way worse when you're in his inner circle in terms of his mania, sociopathic behavior. And I would encourage all of your listeners and viewers to read Jonathan Swan's piece in Axios, which is a blow-by-blow of the Trump insurrection and what Donald Trump was trying to do from the Oval Office to keep his job, despite the fact that he lawfully lost that election in a free and fair election. So we're here now, very big systemic risk to our society. And it's not over. We have to continue to fight him and these lunatics. And whether you like Joe Biden or you don't like Joe Biden, he respects the institutions of our democracy and the things that have made the country great. So we have to figure out what we're doing with this Republican Party of ours that's run amok.
Joe Biden, to me, and this is not new to anybody, represents decency. I don't know if I have that. I think I have a hat right here, actually. This is what Joe Biden reminds me of. Kindness, actually having respect for people, and treating them decently.
Listen, he's one of the most empathetic people that you'll meet. He came to my SALT conference in 2017, gave a great speech. I can tell you straight up, May of 2017, 0.0% idea in his mind about running for president. He thought that was long gone for him. At the ripe old age of 75, and he was not thinking about running for president. So here we are now. He's the 46th president, and thank God for it. And what I would say to you, being in the campaign, and there's a friend of mine that's writing a book called Lucky, and his name is Joe Allen, and he wrote the book Shattered last time. And the book Lucky, he's talking about how lucky we are that Joe Biden won, and how lucky Joe Biden is that Joe Biden won, because he only won by about 73,000 votes in three states. So yes, he won 7 million of the popular vote and he flipped five states. But if you look under the surface, it was only 73,000 vote differential, just slightly higher than what Trump won the last election by. So these are wickedly narrow, very, very close elections.
Oh, 100%. And you mentioned it before, the stats under Donald Trump's leadership, if you want to call it that, he turned America into a Trump organization, almost literally. And anyone who knew him from before in New York, this is very familiar territory.
Embarrassing what he did to the country. I can't figure out why maybe you know, but why are these people still with them? I can't figure it's okay to get it wrong, but it's not okay to stay wrong.
I couldn't agree with you more. And I mean, we're not going to spend all day on this one, but I will just say I'm like the antithesis of a conspiracy theorist. The reasoning for these people to be behind him is so maddening and confusing and irrational that I am becoming a conspiracy theorist and leaning into some of these crazy things. Like I'm just digging for the reason behind it. Other than I do feel like for the past two administrations, which the first time I was not an Obama fan, I was not a voter. The second time I was, I felt like there's a small, well, I guess, larger than you'd know, subset of Americans who feel like they were unrepresented and they're that guy you went to school with that got the shit beat out of them once or twice and felt like they're going to come back and they're going to show you. And no matter whose fault it is, it's never theirs. And that sort of mentality, you know, it just lends itself to someone like this, which is ironic and sad because he is the exact opposite of what they are. But, you know, I don't want to hate on these people. I want to forgive them when they come to their senses. But until then, I got nothing for them.
Well, we
got
to fix it because there's 74 million of them, my brother.
I know. Yeah. I hear you. The last thing I want to ask you about this is I think it actually lends its way into the future of the world and business and Bitcoin and all that kind of stuff you're into with SkyBridge. You mentioned at the top of this that, you know, you knew enough, you were willing to take a flyer. You worked for his administration. What was the moment in your gut, in your head? I'm sure it was months long, maybe even a year long, where you recognized, oh shit, we like, this is no bueno. And like, you had to start making that whatever, you probably still were employed and thinking like, this guy's nuts. Like, what was that moment?
Well, you know, we always thought he was a little off. I mean, I remember I was the garden variety Republican establishment person. I was working for Jeb Bush. Mr. Trump was beating the pants off of these people. He called and recruited me. That was my mistake. This is a learning lesson for people that listen to your podcast. Don't allow your ego and your pride to get in the way of your decision making, because when you do that, you really make stupid decisions. And so my pride, I was intoxicated with the idea that I could work on a presidential campaign for somebody as high profile as Mr. Trump. I was intoxicated by the idea that the remote possibility that we could win, that there would be positive policies and I would actually be close to the American president. And then I made an even bigger mistake, is after he won, I got intoxicated with the idea of going to work for him. Now, my wife, it's pretty well documented in the tabloids, she hates Donald Trump almost as much as Melania hates Donald Trump. I wouldn't say as much. I mean, you got
to
give...
It's very hard to do.
That's, yeah, you got to give Melania the whole position, so I don't want to...
That hatred is palpable. Yeah, I've never seen anything like it.
But she's up there. You know, she's probably in the top five. And so she went to divorce my ass. You know, you got to think about this Italian constitution, right? She loves me, but she's like, I don't want to be anywhere near any of this. And so we patched up our relationship subsequent to my firing, but I allowed myself to get seduced. So did I know he was off? Yes. Was I hitting a cognitive override, like a cognitive dissonance switch in my personality in order to go work for him to fit my narrative that I was a blue collar kid that lived the American dream, built a couple successful businesses. Now I'm going to go work for the American president. Yes. I was trying to take a round peg and I was trying to put it in a square hole due to my ego, due to my pride. And, as you know, you put your pride and ego in something, you can get really wiped out. So, and it's a good segue into investing, by the way, because we both know that the more dispassionate you are, the more objective you are, the more you can cleanse yourself from those nativistic emotions, that primordial state that we're all in, of fight and flight, greed and fear. The better you are as an investor. And so good news is I had my comeuppance. It was very humbling. It was in some ways a blessing. I was able to repair my marriage. I returned to my company wiser, more psychologically minded. And we've had some great measure of success since I returned to the company. Of course, we were set back last year in the COVID-19 crisis. March of 2020 handed us a very bad month, but from April 1st to today, we're up about 33%. So the people that hung in there with us, that very good performance, the people that averaged down did even better. And we're sitting here with great performance right now. We're up 2.5% in our core products in January, with the market being down and the hedge fund industry being down. And of course, we launched our Bitcoin fund in December with $25 million of our own capital. And we've subsequently got that almost to $100 million. We opened it to investors a month ago, January 4th. And across our asset base of $9 billion, we have about $350 million in Bitcoin at current market prices. So the good news is, and this is another lesson, you know, make mistakes, no problem, adapt and pivot. It's not the smartest Darwin said that survived, but it's the species that's capable of doing the most adaptation to the realities of our world. So I'm sitting here right now in my basement, locked in with 20 inches of snow outside. Yes, I am wearing shorts. This is a Brioni from the waist up, but champion. This is champion 1981 shorts. Okay. And I'm dating myself, but I'm talking about those 1981 shorts that you wore in high school gym class. That's what I'm wearing. So I'm Brioni on the waist up, champion on the waist down. And by and large, I'm in a position of gratitude. I'm very grateful that I was able to get through all this. It was a traumatic experience for myself and my family.
Well, I'm a ESQ on the way up, and I'm Under Armour Storm sweatpants for shoveling on the way down. So I'm right here with you. The two things I want to say just to cap that, I think, one, I empathize with you as a husband of a Sicilian Irish woman. So I, my ass is out in the snow if I move the wrong direction.
Well, I mean, you also get parts taken off, and you got to be careful.
True. Yeah. I got quick reflexes.
Sleep with one eye open if you're in a situation like that.
Both eyes. That's why I look tired. Both eyes. And the other part of this, you brought something up, and I just think it's a good life lesson. It was a lesson for me. It came from the famous NBA made famous Worldwide West. He said, "Don't chase the night." I think when you're young and you're going out and partying, don't chase the night means don't be out at midnight after midnight. You don't get what you came for, go home. Bad things happen. Same thing when you chase your ego in business, or life, you chase your ego instead of like actually just taking what comes to you. Bad things happen. And investing, here's our segue. It was the best lesson I ever had because I use it every day in my life. When you have opportunities to come to in investing, and I don't want to spend a bunch of time on GameStop stuff, but that was an opportunity where if you're not there early and you don't know why and you don't know how, you're in a dangerous place. Don't chase the night again.
Yeah, well, that, you know, listen, I mean, if you don't want to talk about GameStop, we won't, but I will tell you this, that was a, I'm going to see the way it's ending right now. I mean, that's a nightmare for a lot of people because, you know, you don't really know what you don't know. And remember, it is the unknown unknowns that crush you in investing. Okay, the known unknowns you can calibrate for, but it's the unknown unknowns. And so, you know, you're out there buying GameStop. The fundamentals are specious. You've got a big short position from some real pros. You can get your clock cleaned. And of course, people got their asses handed to them in the last 48 hours.
Yeah. Well, that's exactly it. Like when I said I want to talk about it, I talk about it all the time. But it's just the Robin Hood thing and all this is like, it's turned into a very different conversation. And my main advice to anyone who's investing, who I look at like me, they're retail, they're not like you or they're institutional. Just don't do things you don't understand. And I know sometimes you're going to miss out on a fortune. You're going to feel bad you didn't get it, but it's far better fate than losing everything is all I would say.
But that's another big lesson, right? No regrets.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay, if you didn't buy Amazon, its inception, who cares? If you missed Uber when the person walked in your office and offered it to you at a $25 million valuation, big deal. What you want to do in our business is you want to grow gradually. You want to take a get rich slow way of going about things. And if you do that, you end up with a really, really good situation.
So I want to talk about, so I don't know if you're familiar with Emmett Peppers. He's on Twitter as well. There was a story came out about him a little while ago. I had him on the podcast. He turned 30,000 into 70 million. Just trading Tesla over the last 6 years or whatever it is. Okay. Spend some time with him talking about those people who are retail investors, myself included, who I would like over the next 10 years to turn my career into this. Like that, I would like to get to a position where investing money that comes in from different opportunities and partnerships and things I do and transition into full-time investor. What advice would you have for people like me and people who want to get into this full-time?
I mean, I'm probably too boring to give this advice. I've never turned $30,000 into $70 million. But what I have done is I took a couple of books like Think and Grow Rich. Remember, I'm from a blue-collar family. I did go to Tufts and Harvard Law School, but my dad was a crane operator. So I have this perspective where I've straddled growing up in a blue-collar neighborhood, but then also working at Goldman Sachs and building some hedge fund businesses. And so what I would tell you is what worked for me. Now, I'm not saying it works for everybody, but worked for me. Seminal books for me were Think and Grow Rich and The Richest Man in Babylon by George Clason. And so what were in those books, you know, Think and Grow Rich, manifest what you want. Literally set the goals, target on what it is you want, be definitive about it. As General Eisenhower said, it's the planning. It's not necessarily the plan, because the plan goes out the window with contact with the enemy. All battle plans do, but it's the planning that helps you get to where you want to go, not necessarily the plan, but you have to concretize in your mind where you want to go. And then the second thing, you know, from Clason's book is save. And I don't care if I was making $300 a week or what I make today, I put 15% of the net disposable income away every single month. I pay myself first, whatever that is. And that turned out to be one of the wisest things that I've done, because I put it in equity. Some of it went into private equity. Some of it went into hedge funds. And then when I created SkyBridge 15 years ago, I put it all into SkyBridge. And our performance, but for a few slips, have been very, very good. And then all of a sudden, lo and behold, you're sitting on a corpus. You're sitting on a body of assets that you can now earn money from, which is basically working for you. Now, there's a misnomer that the money's working for you while you're doing nothing. I don't believe in that, you know, because money's like a garden. Money's like a landscape. And if you have a beautiful outdoor landscape outside your home, while you have to prune the roses, you have to weed the grass, make sure the dandelions aren't growing in the sod. And so you can't just put anything in your life, especially your money, on autopilot. Yeah. Now, having said that, you can farm it out to brilliant people. You know, I have a big chunk of my money with Stephen A. Cohen at 0.72. He's a brilliant, legendary investor. I have no problem paying him 20% of those profits because he's that good. It's actually 25 with him. So you can farm it out, but then you also have to watch those farmers. You can't sit there and say, okay, I got it farmed out. Let me go to Telluride. That's never going to work. I don't believe in that stuff.
Yeah. I mean, listen, I totally agree with that. I think sometimes I get wayward, and I'm sure a lot of people listening to this do. You have a plan. It sometimes doesn't go the way you think it's going to go. And I don't even mean like contact with the enemy. It's just like, I'm in it. Things look like they're going well, but I'm not seeing the progress. It's easy to get down and it's easy to get lazy with your fundamentals. And I think that's one of the things I hope this next generation of investors with Robinhood and M1 Finance and many of the other apps that are out there are learning good fundamentals. And then from there, you can figure out, do I want to get into options, futures, and so forth? So I do think that there is an opportunity for people to get the losses, the quick burns, if you will, to learn their risk tolerance and sort of understand better who they want to be.
Amen. Yeah, absolutely. And you know, here's the other thing I would say, as I'm thinking about your question, is a really good question. Always be learning. Yeah. Always. You got to make sure you're on top of it. You know, talk about like Bitcoin. Byron Wien, you may have heard his name. Yep. He's a legendary investor. He now works at Blackstone, but he was at Morgan Stanley forever, built his career there, originally from Chicago, almost 90 today. And Byron and I gave him a full tutorial on Bitcoin. Now you got Warren Buffett at 90, no mas, doesn't like Bitcoin, it's rat poison. You got Bill Miller at 70, 20 years junior to Warren Buffett, saying, well, it may be rat poison, but the rat may be fiat currency.
Yeah.
And then you got a guy like Byron Wien at 90, willing to learn, willing to open his eyes. Now, that may not mean that he draws the conclusion that he wants to own Bitcoin, but at least he's exposing himself to what is going on in the marketplace and the technical evolutions and technical innovations that are taking place around us, whether they're financial or physical.
could not agree more. I have a 20-month-year-old daughter and another daughter on the way. And my first move was opening an early bird account to try to get them investing before they even know it. To me, if you learn the value of money, not necessarily fiat, whatever money is to you, it's almost like religion at this point, whatever God is to you, and learning, the value of learning. I think those are the two things that will get you through.
We agree. And it doesn't matter where you start. You know, Red Auerbach, who was the Hall of Fame basketball coach for the Celtics, he always had a great line. He had that big cigar. I met him one time in my life. He came to the Harvard Law School in 1986 when I was a student there. And he had that big cigar in his hand. And he had this great cliched line, which I always repeat. Doesn't matter where you start. It's all about where you're finishing. It's all about how you're putting it together to make a championship season. So you could go 0-3, 0-4. It's okay. You just have to adjust, make the adjustments, and always be learning and it's very hard for human beings, but not accept the status quo and not be adverse to changes. Because, you know, what's weird about us is that even though somebody like a Marcus Aurelius would tell you that the only constant is change, for some reason, human beings do not like change. They like to be locked in a certain comfort zone, and they like to be locked into a certain perceived security. But you're way better if you unshackle yourself from that false narrative and accept the vibrancy of what's going on around you.
It's so funny you say that, because I'm sitting in this office, which, like yourself, I've spent a ridiculous amount of time in. And I think I like the constant, the no change in surrounding, but personally in my space, I loathe change. It's the one thing I think I'm afraid of more than spiders, is like things just are completely complacent. I don't feel advancement. I don't feel I'm learning. I don't like, I'll break shit up in my business that doesn't need breaking up, because I just want to be like, we can do something better. Like, it can't be like this. We can do better. So I very much respect your thoughts on that. I think that's a big deal.
That's an interesting, and I'll give this example. So this phone is an iPhone. Yep. The precursor to this was actually an iPod. Yep. And what did Steve Jobs do a couple of years after this astounding success in something known as an iPod? He shot the iPod and killed it. Yep. And he put it in the phone. Yep. And they said to him, well, why'd you do that? He said, well, I didn't do that. Somebody else was going to do that. And so I had to get ahead of it. I had to kill my own business in order to survive and thrive. And so,
well, my producer would agree that my producer of this show in particular would like to tell you that he wish I would stop shooting my business.
Well, okay. Well, maybe you're overshooting, but you know, you get the point. You know, you gotta be willing to break it down.
Absolutely. So I want to use this to turn into the Bitcoin conversation, because you are very strong on it. SkyBridge is making a big bet on it, and I have invested in it. Many of the people listening to this have invested in it. I have bought, and I'm not a holder. I'm a buy, sell guy. I don't know why. My conviction is still mixed on it. And I would love to hear your conviction on it, both as a person, an investor, a guy making money, as well as SkyBridge and institutional. Why do you see Bitcoin having this pathway? And I'm a learner now. I'm just listening to you.
So here's what I would say to you, that you either see this or you don't see it. It is a eureka moment. Some people got it with Amazon. Some people got it with Google. Other people got it with Facebook, where you have this eureka moment where, you know, there was DigiCash that didn't do well, and we ended up with Bitcoin, you know, and there was in several iterations. There's 8,300 cryptocurrencies, yet there is Bitcoin, which is, you know, tell me on the day, let's call it today, is about a $700 billion market cap. And so, couple of things have happened. Again, these are just my observations. There is a fully robust monetary network known as Bitcoin. There's a robust retail network known as Amazon. There's a robust social network known as Facebook. There's ecosystem inside of Facebook, whether it's WhatsApp or Instagram and other sorts of things. But the Facebook ecosystem is a social network. You've got Google is an ad and search network. These things have emerged. They are beating the other players in the space. And so will there be another player like Amazon? Perhaps, but it's very hard. You know, you have 46% market share. And you know, you have 4% of the overall retail, but 46% of online retail. So it's going to be very hard. And so Google has slayed 8,300 potential crypto competitors. Number two, like it or not, there's 140 million people on that network that own a coin or a percentage of a coin that see it as value and are willing to transfer back and forth on that ledger. And I just, you know, not to bore everybody, but go back and read Neil Ferguson's book on money. Literally, the title of the book is Money. He'll give you a 5,500-year rendition on what money is. And let me tell you what money is. One axiomatic fact about money, by and large, is that the money is always worth less than the goods and services you're transacting for. Okay, so I have a piece of paper in my pocket. There's a guy outside who wants to shovel my yard. I'm going to give him three or four pieces of paper with different digits on it. That's an assignation of value. He takes it from me. He goes over to the pizzeria. He gives it to them. They serve him pizza. Yeah. We have a piece of paper that we could argue is made out of fabric. It's arguably worthless. Yet we've all assigned value to it. It's become a part of our debit and credit system. And so when you stop and think about the 5,500 years of currency, well, then it makes sense that we would have a technological evolution of currency that would lead to an advancement. And so lo and behold, here is a cryptocurrency. It's a cryptograph. It's basically a code on the internet that we've assigned value to. And it's scarce. That's another big issue, right? Only 21 million of them. And you've got this robust network that's expanding and growing. It's portable. It's got fungibility. And all of a sudden, it's starting to look and feel and act like digital gold. It may even be better at being gold than gold is at being gold at this point in terms of its portability and ease of use and ease of storability. And so for those reasons, you either get it or you don't. You can sit there and you could say, well, it's just a string of codes. It's absolutely worthless. What is the big deal? But then let me ask you something. What is the URL site Amazon worth? What is the word Coca-Cola worth? It's just a word. It's called Coca-Cola. It's just a word. What is it worth? So all of a sudden you realize, well, wait a minute. I can buy cars.com. That's a URL. It's worth something. Amazon is worth something. The brand Coca-Cola is worth something. Is the word Bitcoin in the international marketplace 12 years since its inception worth something? And I would make the case that it is. Make one last point and then I'll take any question. If you and I were looking at Amazon 12 years after its public offering, we looked at its stock movement, we would have said, okay, wow, it's already built in. You know, Bitcoin's gone from zero or pennies to 35,000. So that must be the end of it. Yet if you bought Amazon 12 years from its IPO and you held it for the following 12 years, you had a 64 times return on your investment. And so what happens in technological networks is that these things ramp exponentially. And if we're right and Bitcoin becomes a store of value akin to gold, well, gold's got a $12 trillion market cap right now. And Bitcoin has a $600-800 billion market cap. There is a huge opportunity in Bitcoin. And of course, you've got fiat currency being produced at an alarming rate. We produced 23.2% more dollars in the last 6 months than we did in the prior 244 years. So it's for all of those reasons, the confluence of those reasons, I think Bitcoin is here to stay. It is an asset class that I'm comfortable with. We can store it now very safely in places like Fidelity Digital Assets. And you know, I think we'll be sitting here 5 or 10 years from now and people will say, wow, I heard about Bitcoin in 2021. It's unfortunate for me that I didn't invest in it because of this is the Amazon moment for this monetary network.
I mean, you have sold me on this. My convictions for Bitcoin have always been, do I believe, like, with the GameStop stuff, but you don't typically see people pushing a stock like you see the people on Twitter going, buy more Bitcoin, buy more Bitcoin. There's nothing, if you're not a technologist, there's nothing fundamental about it you can look at and be like, Amazon, they sell this, they're gaining market share. Like, I get it. I've never actually heard anyone present it to me in a way where it's comparable to Amazon, which you just did. It makes it much more visible for me to see in a line. Like, I guess I'm linear in that sense. Like, I like to see things that fundamentally I understand the chart movement. Here it's like, demand, supply demand. That's all that's going on. People are talking about it constantly. You know, it's hard to peg if you believe it's a real thing or not.
Well, here's that. Listen, I was there. I was a Bitcoin skeptic. In fact, yeah. When Winklevosses came to see me and they attended our Sol conference in 2014 and the coins were $400, they were explaining to me what these coins were going to do. And my reaction to them was, you may be right, but I'm an institutionalist. And right now it hasn't scaled into a full-blown monetary network and it has a tremendous amount of competition. There were new coins innovating and forks of coins and all this other stuff. And this is a weird thing to say, but I like Bitcoin at 30,000 way more than I like Bitcoin at 400, because at 30,000, it has broken through that barrier. It has become that moated network akin to a Google, Amazon, or Facebook. And so, you know, it takes a while. It took me a while to get there. I had to get comfortable with the storability, the fungibility, the robustness of the network, the confidence in the network of the blockchain. There's a term in Bitcoin called double spend. How do I know if I'm sending a coin to you that I can't use that cryptograph for somebody else and then spend it twice? You know, we figured out how to prevent that in a checkbook. We figured out how to prevent that in bank accounts. But how do you prevent that in Bitcoin? Very easy, by the way. There's a simultaneous unfolding of the blockchain in terms of the miners that are going to confirm the crossing of coins across the network. And so, you know, you'd be blown away at how tight that is. You know, it's into the millionths in terms of the iterations, which makes it impossible to crack. And even if you had a supercomputer trying to crack it, well, guess what happens? Supercomputers develop on the nodes that protect Bitcoin. And so you're always in that sort of decentralized soup of security. You know, there's no single entity that's controlling it. And so for those reasons, people like it. And by the way, there's scarcity. You know, you've got 21 million coins, you're limited to that. No way, because it's open source software, can it be recreated? Sure, you can have forks, but then it's no longer Bitcoin. And then you have probably 2 to 3 million coins that have been lost over the last 12 years since the inception of Bitcoin due to poor storage or not understanding what it was. So here we are now, there's probably 18 million overall in circulation, 2-ish million left to be mined. So 16, yeah. 2-ish million left to be mined. And I think that this will be a full-blown, very robust monetary network / store of value in the next 5 years. And I don't want my clients to miss it. Now, having said all that, because you're a trader, I'm a holder of Bitcoin, I recognize its volatility. So I tell my clients, let's buy for you 1, 2, or 3%. You know, you got $1 million under management. That's great. We're going to put 10,000 in Bitcoin or 25,000 in Bitcoin. We're going to put, you know, 100,000 if you have 10. I'm not interested in being a Bitcoin maximalist for the sake of my clients. Now, I may have more of my own money as a percentage of my net worth in Bitcoin because I'm in that business, but I like the idea of clients having a 1% to 3% position. It's not big enough to choke them. If I'm right and we go 10 to 1 on the coin, it is big enough to make a difference in their lives.
Yeah. And the same thing can be said for companies that are holding it as treasury.
100%. Yeah. And that's happening now too.
I think one of the things that is in particular fascinating here is, you know, given the context that you've presented, it is still for the average Joe somewhat complicated to hold, to have wallet, to understand transactions with it. If we're at $35,000 when we're talking right now, and that gets figured out in the Coinbases of the world and whoever the next ones are, set this up for the average person to use it, what is the limit? I mean, it could be at that point in that context, it could be a $300,000 per Bitcoin value. And then that leads to the question of like all of these companies, you know, Elon Musk talking about it now, starting to actually, seems like he actually likes it. Before I thought he was kind of playing with pomp on Twitter, but that's a different thing. What is the impact of Bitcoin's price if all these companies and institutions start holding it?
Well, listen, I mean, it's scarce. And so look at what Michael Saylor did. You know, when Michael Saylor had his eureka moment at 10,000 a coin, he started acquiring it. And then he went out and borrowed money to acquire it. And it, literally on Twitter today, he bought another $10 million of current prices. His point is he's had this eureka moment, and he thinks that anything below 50,000 is a huge value for these coins, because if we're right, and every institution has to have a 1-2% position in Bitcoin, then there's no reason why this can't trade to the market capitalization of gold. And that implies a $400,000 to $600,000 a coin. You know, if you go to the Winklevosses and the Gemini website, they have a very articulate essay called The Case for a $500,000 Bitcoin, and they explain why. Now, let's say they're wrong, and they're wrong by 50%. That's a $250,000 coin.
It's still huge.
Let's say they're wrong by 80%. Okay. And so my point is, that's a $100,000 coin. So my point is, where we are right now, there is a huge opportunity in Bitcoin, and it's not going away. If you're a fuddy-duddy and you've decided that I'm brainless for telling you that a cryptograph on a computer is worth something, then you don't really understand the 5,500 years of our currency. Because if I had wampum or I had a seashell back in the day, and as long as the society said, okay, that's, we're going to transfer that in exchange for goods and services, there you go. You know, there's pieces of paper in my pocket right now. They have green ink on them. They're fabric based, mostly cotton. And I can use those fungibly in the local shops here, or I can use that pay my housekeeper or whatever. Well, what is it exactly? What is a fiat currency? What is it exactly? What's backing it? Someone's, oh, the Federal Reserve is backing it. In what way? You know, there's nothing behind the currency. It's just the understanding of that economy and its understanding of that government, and also the discipline behind that government. But right now in our society, because of the pandemic and the global financial crisis, we have a massive proliferation of fiat currency. And so I don't know, you know, look at that. It usually ends in tears. It may be a good short-term solution. Our politicians are not coming up with long-term policies that are going to improve our society. So they're relying on central bankers to smooth things over with low interest rates and flushing the marketplace with liquidity. And, you know, it's already having a negative effect on our society, because the wealthy are getting wealthier because their assets are going up in nominal value. And the poor and the middle class, they can't get ahead because they don't have any assets. And their wages are going up because of the high levels of unemployment. So look, I have to deal with the world as an investor, as do you, the way it is. Not the way I want it to be, not the way it should be. And there's no ought in our world. In fact, ought is worse than any curse word I've ever uttered. I tell my kids, don't tell me how it ought to be.
Yep.
Let's deal with the world the way it is. It's not a should and ought world. It's a reality-based is world. And I think there's room for Bitcoin. It is a technological evolution. Every time we've embraced technology, whether we went from a horse and buggy to a horseless carriage, or a telephone to a video conference, we're moving and advancing technologically. It would make sense that our money would also move and advance technologically, and it has with Bitcoin.
Could not agree more. The fuddy-duddies, I can assure you there's very few of them listening to this podcast. Right. I'd say most of them have Bitcoin. But I would argue there's still the people who I think just don't quite embrace the future, and that ultimately you either see the future as it is or you don't. And I'm not very speculative on where we're going. I think automation and tech and currency, I mean, the case that I basically have used in countless conversations is just gambling. How often do you go on FanDuel and gamble and you can't get paid quick enough to make the bet on the next game and the next time? And therefore money is too slow. Need innovation. And here it is.
I couldn't agree more. Yeah. We're in sync, you and me. Look at that. Huh?
Shit, I'll stop right there. We're good. That's all I needed to hear. If you're interested in self-directed investing, from startups to crypto and public markets, my Substack is a great way to learn how professional investors screen, review, and pull the trigger on deals. Join the largest community of micro investors and startup founders on Substack by going to katoon.com.